KALW in San Francisco, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. This week's election in the Netherlands received worldwide headlines, with most of the attention on Geert Wilders, leader of the far-right, anti-Muslim, anti-EU party for freedom. He came in second, but he increased his party's number of seats. Even though he didn't win, he did come in second, resulting in an overall shift to the right in the Netherlands. Joining us to discuss coverage is Adi Scholte, a freelance journalist based in Amsterdam. Hi, Adi. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Nice to have you. On today's Media Roundtable, we're also discussing coverage of immigration, uncertainty and fear about Donald Trump's deportation executive order continues across the country. So how are the media covering this ongoing story? Roque Planas is a national reporter with the Huffington Post covering Latin American and Latino issues. Hi, Roque. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
Great to have you back. As we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight reporting that stood out this week. So, Roque Planas with the Huffington Post, what caught your attention this week?
Well, I'm actually looking at one that was published quite a while ago. It's about how Border Patrol agents, it's by Andrew Becker, and it was with the Center for Investigative Reporting. And if you look up Center for Investigative Reporting, Border Patrol polygraphs, you'll find it. It came out in 2010, and what he had done was basically to FOIA the results, the summary results of applicants to the Border Patrol's polygraph test, their lie detector test. And what he found was that in many cases, people had passed every single step all the way up to the polygraph, which was the last step, and then admitted a whole series of crimes. One person said that they couldn't remember a crime, but they had woken up in a kitchen doused in blood. Mm. Other people confessed to trafficking drugs on a massive scale. One person was later prosecuted because he admitted to having a large cache of child pornography. And I think in light of Ron Nixon's story that we're going to talk about later, it's an interesting look back at how this is a systemic problem that Border Patrol has had to fight.
Yeah, we're going to talk with Ron Nixon of the New York Times a little later in the show about a story he wrote looking at what's happened over the past decade. Dozens of ICE agents and contract guards have been arrested and charged with beating people, smuggling drugs into detention centers, raping detainees, and accepting bribes. And Roque, are you finding that this angle gets gets attention? Because until I read this piece by Ron Nixon, I didn't really hear much about background checks or polygraph checks.
I think the Center for Investigative Reporting did tremendous work back in, you know, that time period, 2010, 2011, and so forth. I think, you know, my colleague Molly O'Toole at Foreign Policy Magazine raised this issue. She was, I think, the first one to get a hold of this memo from CBP that was raising these objections to the burdensome process that Border Patrol agents go through. But I think we're going to hear more and more about it because we have a lot of very good reporters who are very focused right now on immigration because it's one of the big sort of driving issues of the national conversation right now.
Right. And then also later in the show, we'll talk with you about coverage of how Donald Trump's budget will affect this. So we've got kudos for Andrew Becker with the Center for Investigative Reporting, and we'll put a link on our website, yourcallradio.org. That is Roque Planas. He's a national reporter with the Huffington Post. And what about you, Adi Scholte, who's joining us from Amsterdam? What caught your attention in the news this week?
Well, of course, the immense attention for the Dutch elections in the international press. But there's one story that I would like to draw attention to. It's by Simon Cooper of the Financial Times, and he's a well-known reporter in the Netherlands. He's well-known in the Netherlands. But he made a really nice story in a small town in the north of the Netherlands, which happened to be one of the poorest and least appreciated towns in the Netherlands. With a strong support for the Geert Wilders party. And he found out that it was not really that bad. He didn't think it was that bad. And it's poor for Dutch standards, but maybe not in international and even American standards. and he also he went there as a to talk to several people in the streets and in the mayor and the asylum seekers who are housed there, and so he painted a more diverse picture than just telling about angry white folks about who are angry that asylum seekers are based in their community.
Did you feel that was missing from a lot of the pieces that you've read over the last couple of weeks?
Well, some pieces on sometimes when you read something in the international press about your own country, you don't really recognize it. But some pieces are really fine and try to draw attention to things that are maybe even overlooked in your own country. So that's right. And this piece by Simon Cooper was actually translated into Dutch and appeared in the Dutch newspaper as well. So that points out that I wasn't the only one who thought it was a special story.
All right, so kudos to the Financial Times for that story. And that is Adi Scholte, a freelance journalist based in Amsterdam. And you can find these articles at yourcallradio.org. So, Adi, you said sometimes when you read international pieces about your own country, they get a lot wrong or it just sounds very foreign to you. Overall, what are your thoughts on the attention that your election has been receiving? We've been hearing about it here in the U.S., and it just got so much attention around the world.
Yes, it is amazing, but I think it's quite understandable that the American and British and the European and international press is giving so much attention to it now, as it's seen as the first nationwide election in a Western country after the election of Donald Trump and the inauguration of Donald Trump, and with of course Geert Wilders is drawing the most attention as the quote unquote Dutch Donald Trump, which he isn't, but we can talk about that later. I was surprised by the amounts, I must say, because I went to one of the events with Wilders, and there were about, I think, 100 camera crews. I think that the BBC even sent two crews to be sure that they got the right shots. So that doesn't happen often in the Netherlands.
Before we dive in and talk about this election, your election process and political process is very different from ours. So can you just give us a brief overview of the number of parties you have in the Netherlands and how your system works?
Yes. Well, after this last election, we have 13 parties in the parliament. The parliament has 150 seats. And there's no threshold in the election, so you just have to get a 1/105th of the vote to get one seat in parliament. And that makes it a very representative system. We don't have any districts or other ways to limit the number of parties. And, these parties, they range from, let's say, the Geert Wilders party on the far right, to the Socialist Party, which in its history was a Maoist Marxist party that evolved over the years to become a more, well, let's say, radical social democratic party, Socialist Party. And we also have the Animal Party, Animal Rights Party. It's called the Party for the Animals. So there are all kinds of tastes in the Dutch politics. So what happens now is, well, the biggest party is now the Liberal Party, VVD, and now after the election, they need to form a coalition government with at least four parties to gain a majority in parliament.
And all eyes were on Geert Wilders, the head of what's called the Party for Freedom. He's the leader of that far-right, anti-Muslim, anti-EU party. Tell us what else we need to know about Geert Wilders, and how different is he from other politicians in the Netherlands?
Well, Geert Wilders is a long-time politician. he started with the Safe Data, so that the party is now the largest party. And he broke away from the party in 2004 over the issue of the Turkish membership of the European Union. He didn't want to have the possibility that Turkey would ever become a member of the EU, and his party wouldn't agree to that. So he made a row over that, and he left his party and formed his own party, which was quite successful the first time that he took part in the election. He gained 9 seats, and after that 15 seats, and then 24, and then 15, and then and now 20 again. So he's a consistent power in the Dutch politics, and his influence is, well, we could talk about that maybe later on, but he poses himself as an outsider on a very strong anti-elite platform, and an anti-Muslim platform. His latest manifest in this election was all put down on one piece of paper. Just a few points, just 10 points, very short, where other parties have make little books about all their proposals and their plans for the coming 4 years. But he's very radical in saying that all the mosques should be closed, there should be no more Islamic migrants, the Quran should be banned, but he backed away from it a little bit. He thinks that that's going to save us a lot of money as well. So that's basically Geert Wilders as a politician.
And again, he came in second, but he increased his party's number of seats. How much support does he have?
Well, he had more support in the polls before the election, especially last year, and especially after, maybe that's something also interesting to know, after he was convicted by a court for inciting discrimination of Moroccans, especially. In a way that increased his support, and in the polls he was stronger than he was now at the actual election. So, well, yes, he's quite strong, but that's his support among voters. So we now know that he has about 14 or 15% of the voters. But that's his power base among voters. But his influence on other parties, that is a very major force, and that makes his influence much bigger than the number of seats that he has.
And it seems like you have a better sense of where your public stands than we do, because half of our country doesn't vote. And in this election in the Netherlands, you had an 80% voter turnout.
Yes, we did. This was high for the Netherlands, but it's normally for the national elections about 75%. So it's a bit higher than usual. And maybe that's also because the elections were framed as a contest between populism and other parties, and the importance of the position of Geert Wilders and other parties that campaigned against him, and other parties that maybe campaigned against him, of course, but also copied some of his views. So there were lots of reasons to go out and vote for many people.
Eddie Schulte is a freelance journalist based in Amsterdam, and we are talking about this week's election in the Netherlands, which received worldwide headlines, most of the attention on Geert Wilders, leader of the far-right anti-Muslim, anti-EU party for freedom. He came in second, but he did increase his party's number of seats. And Addie will be with us for a few more minutes if you have any questions or comments about media coverage, about these elections, and just overall anti-immigrant sentiment around the globe, the way that it was framed in the media is that what happened in the Netherlands is really a litmus test for what's ahead in Germany and France. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Roque Planas, a national reporter with the Huffington Post covering Latin American and Latino issues. And Roque, you haven't been covering these elections, but what are your thoughts about the coverage that we're seeing more broadly about anti-immigrant sentiment around the globe? Specifically, you know, most media lumped what's happening in the Netherlands and what could possibly come in Germany and France.
Sure. I mean, it's definitely interesting that it seems to be that what we're experiencing in the United States is part of this sort of more global, I wouldn't say global, but like American and European sentiment of you know, national identity and the sort of doubt about national identity feeding into populist politics. When I look at Donald Trump, you know, I have a sort of, my analogy is to look at places in Latin America where the political party system broke down. You had the rise of outsiders. So like places like Peru with Fujimori, places like Venezuela with Hugo Chavez, or Argentina with Juan Perón, you know, but they, with the exception of, I mean, they all have their sort of racial national identity elements, but it does seem that we do share that with Europe, this sort of sentiment amongst a big percentage of the population that the country that they grew up in is no longer the country that they feel, you know, 100% part of, and it's driving this sort of international movement of populist politicians.
Hmm. And Addie, in the United States, we have been seeing a rise in anti-immigration hate speech and also hate crimes, in some cases deadly hate crimes. Are you seeing that in the Netherlands?
Well, in speech, you can see it, especially on social media, in violent acts. Not so much. I think we're quite happy to be a very pacifistic and country, and we've had our cases of political violence, but just normally in the streets, well, people might experience maybe some words, but not violence in a big way. There are threats. There have been some attacks on mosque with firebombs once. These guys were apprehended and they were convicted as terrorists. And so there have been some incidents, which is serious, but especially online, the words that are used are really, really angry, and there's a lot of talk about how there's a war going on, or there might be a war, a civil war, and people feel very threatened, and but they also make their own threats. So that is disturbing and something that we should keep an eye on. And if you look at Germany, their extreme right violence is much more common in parts of Germany. So I hope it doesn't spread to violence. But the speech is already very aggressive sometimes.
And Addie, before we let you go, how is Donald Trump being covered in the Netherlands?
Well, very intensely. I think we are very focused on the United States. We've always been that for last decades, very critical. I would say that 80 or 90% is critical of Donald Trump, to the extent that some people who are a bit more nuanced think that it's overdone and that we should give him a try. But especially since the inauguration and since he took office, and we've seen all these incidents and chaos. It toned down a little bit, maybe because of our own election, maybe because of what happened in the United States, maybe because we're getting used to crazy things from the White House, if you allow me to say that. But we've there's still a lot of worry, I think, about how it's going to work out for our relation with the United States and NATO, with the EU.
Hmm. And, Addy, we have a listener question. They want to know how fearful immigrants and refugees are in Holland. Are you seeing the same kind of fear there that we are seeing here in the United States?
Well, to a small extent, there is some fear. I think that people might be a little bit more at ease now that the big win of Geert Wilders was projected and expected, or hasn't turned out to be the case. So, but there's still a sort of anxious feeling, like, how is this going, and will I ever be accepted as a full member of society, as a citizen with complete acceptance? And so I'm afraid that feeling will not go away so easily, and will be with us for quite some time. Some people are saying, well, okay, we're going back to Morocco or Turkey, whatever. Sometimes they do that because they see more opportunities there, but there can also be some sort of factor because they feel alienated in the Netherlands.
Hmm. Mohadesa Najumi, a writer and social scientist, wrote a piece in the Huffington Post called The Real Truth About Dutch Racism, Life as a Moroccan. And she writes that if you ask the average Dutch person what they think about racism, the usual answer is, we have no problem here. But she points out that in Amsterdam, where she's been living, you have Turks, Moroccans, Indonesians making up very large communities living side by side with the white Dutch.
Yes, I think sometimes they live side by side, sometimes they mix up more. I think in the last few years there has been more attention to racism and all sorts of racism, overt or maybe more covert institutional racism. We've had a lot of debates about the Dutch role in the slavery trade and in slavery in general, in the history, and how should we deal with that history. It's a discussion that is very heated, the discussion about Black Piet, a tradition in the Netherlands with the blackface figure that went very, very emotional on both sides. But I think that there is a shift, and there is in some spaces there is more sensitivity for the issue of racism, and other groups are feeling threatened by the discussion about racism. For instance, our prime minister wrote a letter published in newspapers saying that the normal Dutch should not be just accused of racism because they like this tradition of Black Piet or whatever, or they criticize some things. It's a very sensitive topic in the Netherlands, and I guess it will continue to be that way, but I see some developments in it that on the one hand polarize things, and on the other hand make people more aware of their own prejudices and racism. It's a difficult topic for a lot of people.
And it's interesting that the Green Party is run by Jesse Klaver, a son of a Moroccan father and part Indonesian mother.
Yes, it is. A lot of people were not aware of his background until recently, a lot of voters, I think. And he doesn't really, well, to some extent, he makes a story about it, but our Speaker of the Parliament, Internaal, she was born in Morocco. The mayor of the second largest city in the Netherlands, Rotterdam, was born in Morocco. So we see all these migrants. They're not considered migrants anymore. It's just part of society. So, yes, all kinds of things happen here in the Netherlands, and it's just a mix of these developments.
Well, Addy, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
That is Addy Schulte. He's a freelance journalist based in Amsterdam. We've been talking about the elections in the Netherlands, receiving worldwide headlines this week, and you can find coverage at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after the break, we will speak with Roque Planas, national reporter with the Huffington Post, and Ron Nixon, homeland security correspondent with the New York Times, about coverage of immigration. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Se channan liara viisiri o kodi taras lähernari, vienes viedes karlahe.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW, Local Public Radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. Also, tweet us at Your Call Radio.
This is Your Call's Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are going to now talk about coverage of immigration with Roque Planas, national reporter with the Huffington Post, covering Latin American and Latino issues. And now I would like to welcome Ron Nixon to the show. Ron is a Homeland Security correspondent at the New York Times, author of the best-selling book, Apartheid, South Africa's Global Propaganda War. And Ron is co-founder of the Ida B. Wells Society for Investigative Reporting, which aims to increase the ranks and profile of reporters and editors of color in investigative reporting. Hi, Ron. Welcome to the show.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Thank you for your reporting on ICE and immigration. I want to start off with a general question for both you and Roque. And Roque, why don't you take this one first? We've had you on many times talking about immigration. What are your thoughts on ongoing coverage? Do you think that reporters are doing a good enough job of looking at how things are working systemically?
I mean, I think that that's one of the big things that's sort of yet to be seen, that is a transition that a lot of people are going to make. One of the things that happened right after Donald Trump took office was this big sort of immigration sweep that is part of a routine annual series of arrests. But this year was a little different because there was so-called collateral arrests, or people who were arrested while ICE was detaining someone they'd been targeting. So the result was that about a quarter of the people arrested in Operation Crosscheck, as it's called, had no criminal record and wouldn't have been considered priorities by the previous administration. So I think what we've seen that's been really good, and I think much better than in the previous administration, was a lot of reporters across the country finding these individual cases and highlighting what they mean within the bigger trend. What I think that sort of remains to be seen, and I'm curious to see how things play out, is to see, you know, what's actually changing systemically, right? And what is it that Donald Trump as a president is going to do that's going to be very different from what Barack Obama did as a president, or George W. Bush did as a president, right? Because I think a lot of the ways that immigration enforcement works, right, what we're going to be seeing is a lot of continuity. Not, I think more continuity than innovation, although it's clear that the system's going to be a bit more erratic with Donald Trump in charge.
Hmm. Ron, what would you add?
I think I would agree with most of that. Well, actually, virtually all of that. I think that the difference will be in terms of how this administration squares the fact that it will, does not have the money nor the personnel to carry out the president's plan to deport a record number of people. I think they're going to discover, or they're already discovering, that they're running into some of the same limitations that the Obama administration ran into when it started to try and ramp up deportation. So I think that's going to be, you know, a major part of the story. I think the other thing too is to pay more attention to the so-called 287G program, which is where they give money and basically deputize local authorities to act as immigration, act in immigration enforcement. That was something that the Obama administration sort of ramped down during their 8 years, but something that the president has indicated that he would like to pursue, and that the Department of Homeland Security has you know, told ICE and Customs and Border Protection to try, particularly along the border, to get more of these local law enforcement agencies on board.
And Ron, what are your thoughts about reporting on how the culture at ICE has really changed under Donald Trump? You and your colleagues had a piece, Immigration Agents Discover New Freedom to Deport Under Trump. And you report that some of the people who are not comfortable with some of the racism coming from agents, they feel silenced. So can you just talk about just what goes on with reporting? I mean, how much access do you have to ICE? Do you always have to talk to agents anonymously? How do you find them?
Well, you know, I've covered Department of Homeland Security for a number of years, and so over that time, you develop sources within the agency. People are a little bit more reluctant now to talk than they were before. So, you know, we're having to talk to people, you know, giving them anonymity. But there's a fair amount of access. You know, I still talk to people within the agency, and that they sort of lay out. So they're basically they're two minds here. One is these people who felt handcuffed by the previous administrations, and not just the Obama administration, but the Bush administration too, and that they weren't allowed to go after people. And some of these people had what they called their Trump files, which is when Trump was elected, they had these files of people that wouldn't have been a priority under the Obama administration, but that had deportation orders. So now it's like, well, we go after these people and we get them. On the other hand, there are people within the agency who say, well, you know, we, despite our job and what we are given, our mission to do is to deport these people, we still have to do it humanely and treat people with respect. And they have noted that there are, you know, things inside the agency that kind of give them pause. Like, you know, there's been a number of cases of lawsuits for gender and racial discrimination. There are, you know, allegations, and in some cases where there's been you know, just favoritism. So they are concerned that, well, now these people are being let loose within the agency to kind of do this. And if you treat your fellow workers like this, you know, how do you treat people that you don't know?
And ICE has more than 20,000 employees spread across 400 offices in the United States and 46 countries. Again, the Trump administration wants to hire 10,000 more. Roque, what has your experience been in gaining access and then also just getting information about how these raids are conducted?
I mean, I think this time around, ICE was a little bit more close-lipped just because of the whole sort of politicization of the thing. I mean, I think it was definitely hard to get, you know, any statements about the level of criminality and of the people that they were arresting, and sort of what the targeting was, because it was really clear that there was a departure, but it was a sort of new administration, and I think people were sort of cautious about you know, what they wanted to say. I mean, I think, at least for me, historically, ICE has been also sort of a little bit less willing to sort of discuss what they do than, say, Border Patrol, who feels that, you know, as an agency, they're sort of, you know, no, they don't get the respect that they deserve, and they're sort of out in the middle of nowhere and are a little bit more vocal, including during the election. The union was quite vocal.
And in one of Ron's pieces, he reports that a supervisor in Northern California described a typical operation with teams of at least five members rising before dawn, meeting as early as 4 a.m. to make arrests before their targets depart for work. What is the case in Texas, Roque? I mean, is it similar, or do they differ? How does that work?
I mean, I think at least this time around, a lot of what was happening was that you saw ICE agents, at least, and this is all based on allegations of what people said who experienced the arrests or who live in the city, but that, you know, you saw ICE agents getting a little bit closer to schools, that, you know, conducting operations at a local HEB grocery store, and just generally sort of arresting people that wouldn't have been considered a priority before. So that the net effect has been that people who've lived there for 20, 30 years now suddenly feel quite a bit more insecure than they used to. I mean, if the notion that the Trump administration was going for, which they were pretty open about, I think, was that they were going to sort of eliminate what the Obama administration had created, which was this sort of sense of security that some undocumented folks felt, that they're really sort of moving in that direction of what, you know, they used to call self-deportation, to make people so sort of scared that they're willing to leave the country on their own. I mean, that's something that's come up repeatedly when talking both to people that have lived here for a long time and then also people that work, say, in the school system or other places that they come into contact with a lot of undocumented folks. You know, you hear people say, wow, you know, this is really worrisome to me, and I'm considering going back to the place that I came from.
Hmm. And Ron, there was a piece in the LA Times about immigration agents, some in plain clothes, targeting courtrooms in California, Arizona, Texas, and Colorado. And then there have also been reports about ICE agents raiding and arresting restaurant workers, going into restaurants. So as a reporter, I mean, are you getting phone calls from people who've been affected by lawyers? I mean, how are you keeping up with all of the activity that's happening?
Yeah, you're getting a lot of that. You know, even a call from my mother when there was a raid on restaurants in Alabama. I got a call from my mom on this. So I'm getting calls from everywhere, attorneys, immigration advocates, and so you just try to, you know, prioritize things because you know, a lot of things are allegations. They're unsubstantiated. A lot of times you'll spend chasing down rumors that turn out not to be true.
Right.
So, you know, it's difficult because there is a lot of fear. And then remember, there is also cases in New York where you have people pretending to be ICE agents and having people, you know, give them money or something to go away. So there's all of this level of fear that's out here, and a lot of things that I get are passed on third or fourth hand. But you try and write it down because you don't know when it may be true.
Hmm. Ron Nixon is a Homeland Security correspondent with The New York Times and author of the best-selling book Apartheid, South Africa's Global Propaganda War. Ron is co-founder of the Ida B. Wells Society for Investigative Reporting, which aims to increase the ranks and profile of reporters and editors of color in investigative reporting. And Roque Planas is a national reporter with The Huffington Post, where he covers Latin American and Latino issues. And if you'd like to join us, we're talking about coverage of immigration, about ICE agents. Again, Donald Trump says he wants to hire 10,000 more ICE agents. Well, who are these people? What is the background check? And the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Roque, what are your thoughts on media coverage of the Trump budget that was just released yesterday, which includes massive, massive new spending for the military and the Department of Homeland Security?
Sure. I mean, I think this is one of the things that I've been looking at and that Ron mentioned, and I think he's absolutely right. There's a lot of bureaucratic constraints on what DHS can do. And, you know, this sort of, there is a lot of fear right now. And like I said, I think that fear is being ginned up by this, the fact that immigration enforcement is becoming more erratic, that ICE is targeting people that they didn't historically target, that ICE is moving a little bit closer to locations like, you know, schools and churches that they used to avoid. I think that there's a lot of fear, but in practical numbers, I mean, I just, you know, I would leave for colleagues in Washington to talk about the budget, but I mean, my view of that budget, right, is that I think it seems like nobody likes it, and it's going to be at least tinkered with. I think certainly hiring 15,000 new immigration agents, 10,000 at ICE and 5,000 at Border Patrol over 4 years is probably unrealistic. I mean, even by Border Patrol's own estimates, if they are going to hire 5,000 agents, they're not even going to get start. They're not even going to clear their backlog until next year. There's about 1,200 positions currently open. They're not even going to clear that backlog until next year, even in the most optimistic case scenario. So I think, you know, it'll take a while to play out, but I think the initial sort of impression is, you know, that this is a sort of statement on the part of the Trump administration that it's, you know, putting its priorities sort of in this, you know, it's going to be a very sort of militaristic style, you know, a lot of money to military, a lot of money to DHS, and the money that DHS, Department of Homeland Security, does have is going to be shifted to immigration enforcement regardless of whether or not that makes sense, because we don't have enough space to detain and deport people that will get arrested.
And specifically, you've got $52 billion more from the military. Now, this is separate from the VA. And then Homeland Security, almost $3 billion more with cuts to so many other things, public broadcasting, social services, the EPA, the list goes on. Ron, what are your thoughts about how the budget is being covered?
Well, I think people are covering the budget. I think right now, initially, there is this sort of shock because of the nature of the cuts and where money is being shifted to. But I think it should be tampered down just a little bit because this is, you know, again, sort of what the president's priorities are, not necessarily what Congress is going to approve. And one of the reasons I say that is because within that budget are these, you know, proposed cuts. They now say that those cuts won't happen, but there were proposed cuts to the Coast Guard, and included in that was a $600 million contract to build a ninth Coast Guard security cutter, national security cutter. Well, that $600 million was put in there by Thad Cochran, senator from Mississippi, who also happens to be the chairman of the Appropriations Committee in the Senate. So I can't see anything passing, you know, that committee when you're talking about cutting one of his pet projects. And, you know, Ingalls Shipyard is huge in Mississippi. He's supplying thousands of jobs to people. So this is one example, though, and there are other things in the budget that affects members of Congress, Republicans and Democrats, that are pretty parochial interest that I don't see this particular budget passing the way in which it is now.
Mm. Today, it is our media roundtable, and we are discussing media coverage of immigration and the budget, ICE agents. Donald Trump wants to hire 10,000 more. That's Ron Nixon. He's a Homeland Security correspondent with the New York Times, and Roque Planas is a national reporter with the Huffington Post. What about coverage of just the racism that we are seeing as a result of someone like Steve Bannon, who is in the White House and is making decisions about just very important issues. And I bring this up because we have received calls that we have not received before. Our senior producer is from Iran, and someone called and said something about Muslims beheading people. And after she said she's a Muslim, she was told to get the heck out of the country. I mean, we didn't get calls like this before. So things have really, really shifted. We recently talked about the two Indian men who were shot in Kansas. The man who shot them said that he thought they were from Iran. One of them died. Roque, do you think the media are really having an honest conversation about what we're facing right now?
I mean, I think that those tensions, those stories tend to get a strong level of national attention. I know certainly my organization cares a lot, and a lot of other national organizations care a lot. And I know that, you know, I mean, Ron can speak to the Times, but certainly they put a great emphasis on the changing nature of race in the country. So I think that the dominant, you know, sort of news organizations are definitely putting a lot of emphasis. I mean, I almost feel as though what we don't see, right, is because I think that element of the country has been there for a while. What's happened is it's become more vocal because a lot of people feel emboldened by Trump. But I think that one of the things that maybe doesn't get enough attention that it deserves is that I still do think that a sort of hardcore, you know, right wing nativism remains very much, I think, sort of off to the fringes. I don't think the vast majority of the American public does think that way. And I think, you know, it's sort of because of the way that our system is polarized politically, it can become difficult to understand that. I think, you know, I mean, what I would love to see in terms of media coverage on race and racism is just a sort of renewed emphasis on, you know, civic engagement, and, you know, why is it that, you know, Latino voters vote in such low numbers? You know, it's not because of apathy. You know, that why is it, you know, that, you know, what is our, you know, what do politicians and civic groups have to do to get that people who I think is the majority, right, the who have more sort of moderate open views, to be engaged in the political process? I mean, when I see what's going on in this country, I see a country where neither political party is very representative of the general public, and that's why we're in the situation that we are today with this dysfunctional polarization.
Ron, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think that, you know, in terms of the coverage, I definitely think that there is a focus both from the local level and the national level. Again, you know, I don't think this is a new phenomenon in terms of the kinds of things that you're seeing. I think it's, one, I think it's just being covered more. But if you look at data from the Southern Poverty Law Center that tracks, you know, hate groups and, you know, right-wing militias and those kinds of things, those things have been growing for years.
Mm-hmm.
And online, you know, that's been growing for years, too, with some of those sites. So I think it's just that there is more of a focus on it, and it gets more attention than it has in the past. But I think it has been there for years. And again, if you look at some of the data from the Southern Poverty Law Center, you do see that there was a growth in the past 8 years in particular.
It has been there for years. It's just that we haven't had someone running for president who has called Mexicans rapists, says we're going to get the bad dudes. When he talks about blacks, he always says, you know, inner city violence. And so he's brought this rhetoric up to a new level. And I remember when he was running for president, I mean, you just heard these things repeated over and over again, especially in the broadcast media.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, you've had this, and in recent years, you haven't had this kind of rhetoric, but, you know, in the not-too-distant past, I mean, you're starting with, like, the Willie Horton ads under George H.W. Bush running against Dukakis. You had, you know, this kind of thing with Jesse Helms running in North Carolina in 1990 with the Black Hands well, the White Hands ad with the rejection slip saying, you know, you needed the job, but they had to give it to a minority. on to, like, the congressman from Iowa, Steve King. So it's been there. I mean, you have had people say these kinds of things before, even presidential candidates.
Okay. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I would agree with all that. I'm actually surprised that you all haven't gotten more hateful comments like that, because I get them all the time.
You know, I think, I honestly think that we're pretty lucky. We don't get that much hate. But, we're an all-female staff here, and it does stand out, and it's pretty disconcerting. It's not something you ever want to get used to, I don't think.
Sure, yeah. No, not to make light of it, but it's been such a constant... Even going back, like when I worked at the Texas legislature, I worked briefly there as a fellow for the Hispanic Research Council, and when I would answer the phone and say my name, every now and then I would just get, an earful, just for having a Spanish-sounding name.
Wow.
Right. We're not immune. I wish I could play you some of the voicemails that I've gotten of everything from, people calling me the N-word to everything else. So, I think there are a couple of things that make it seem more prevalent than maybe in the past. One is social media, and that there are ways for people to access, given access to us in ways that they weren't before. Mm. And so I think that plays a role, because you can do it from anywhere now. At one time you had to go and sit down behind a computer to do this stuff. Now you can just do it on your smartphone anywhere. So I think that plays a role. The technology, change in technology has played a role in that too. But again, I do think that there are some people who are emboldened, but I think a lot of this has just been sitting there under the surface for years, and it's starting to be more, people are just being more vocal about it.
Well, let's hope that public media stays very strong so we can continue having these real and honest conversations. Ron Nixon is Homeland Security correspondent with the New York Times, author of Apartheid, South Africa's Global Propaganda War, and co-founder of the Ida B. Wells Society for Investigative Reporting. They are aiming to increase the ranks and profile of reporters and editors of color in investigative reporting. And Ron, we'd love to do a show about that. That's so important. And Roque
Definitely.
Planas is a national reporter with the Huffington Post, where he covers Latin American and Latino issues. Ron and Roque, thank you for joining us. Thanks for your reporting.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. Thanks, Rose.
Thank you. Your Call is produced here at KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan produced today's show. Helena Murphy is assistant producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And David Latulip is our studio engineer. You can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thanks for joining us.